Hello, dear listener, and welcome back to Flight Through Entirety, the only Doctor Who podcast full of salty fats and vintage wines and all those Michelin star sauces. We're delicious. I'm Nathan.
I'm James.
I'm Todd.
And I'm an NHS slightly see-through oversized Brian Nylon 90 for this one.
Of course you are. Well, the show ended its two-year run mere months ago, and so all of Britain is tuning in this week to find out whether it's even possible to conceive of a Doctor Who after the shock departure of Camille Kadoorie. Can anything ever be the same again after the first meeting of Smith and Jones?
Yeah.
What can happen on an average beautiful day? You never know. Summer brings seasonal changes. It gets hot for a brother. On a beautiful
10 out of 10 for teeth. Excellent teeth on the new gill. Very good.
I mean, we open, don't we? Let's do this.
Doing a street, yeah. A scene again.
Yeah, yeah. And last week, last Christmas, we restarted the show with that opening shot of the moon heading down to Earth and then Donna's wedding. And I guess that was a way of saying, well, the show is restarting, but we've sort of found a way to do it. Here we don't have an opening thing. We go straight into the
opening title.
Yeah, yeah. And then we see Martha. And I guess she's introduced to us very economically. It's a pretty good scene.
It's a very now television scene, like having the mobile phone and cutting between all of her family and introducing. Could you imagine back in 1980 with Tegan having a phone going off in the house and then she's talking to her grandfather and then Auntie Vanessa has a phone in the car or some big, huge gadget thing. And then she's
Colin Fraser. She speaks to Colin
Fraser, you know, and then they go down the freeway and then they find a police box and they talk to that. Could you imagine that? That's a great way to introduce all the family and so many regulars.
And then her aunt gets horribly mad.
In 25 minutes. But here, it's all done in like 2 minutes.
And it's very clear that what Martha's job is in the family is to kind of smooth things over. Like Tish calls to kind of get her to persuade her father not to bring Annalise, who is one of the great characters of the RTD era.
He memes these creatures, doesn't he?
Wonderful. Well, we had Naris last time, who I just think is spectacular.
I was about to say, like, you know, he's trying, like, for three episodes in a row, we had the wonderful Jackie, and then it's like we don't have Jackie anymore, so now we've got Naris, and now we've got Annalise. I mean, she never appears ever again. But, you know, that joke at the end of the episode is just, I just burst out laughing where Martha's mum says, you stole my husband. He seduced me. And it's just like, he really, did he? Like, it's like, oh, my God.
So we've got some people who've gone on to do incredibly well as well. Like all of these people, like Joa Ando has been in a bunch of things. Russell's used her again. She's got a big career. Yes. Gugu Mbatha-Raw is in everything these days, including the sort of spectacular San Junipero from Black Mirror. And then Reggie Yates, who was apparently famous, but we didn't know about him then.
That's her brother, Leo.
Yeah. And so Leo comes back, but not quite as often as Russell had originally hoped, I think. Mm. But Tish will be following Tish's career. She has a very eventful week.
Yeah. And again, he's done the same thing with Rose, hasn't he? No pre-title sequence. I was trying to think, why is this like Rose's introduction? Oh, yeah, because
this is the new girl, front and center, and this is her family, and she's here to stay.
I really meant what I said in the opening. It was really hard to imagine what Doctor Who could do without the Powell estate, without Mickey and Jackie and Rose, who had been so important to the show. And then, you know, you can't do the same thing again. Russell has to choose to do something different. And the shocking difference, I think, with the family is that they're
upper middle class. I was going to say, because Rose isn't upper middle class.
No.
More working class.
Yeah.
And here we've got an actress of colour cast in the role. And so the whole supporting cast obviously is. And it's well overdue in Doctor Who.
Yeah.
Well overdue. Yes, it's not like they had to powder up Louise Jamison.
But that is actually sort of a huge thing, isn't it? Suddenly you've got this massive cast of black actors as semi-regulars. And I think it's a fantastic thing. And I think also it's meant to kind of sweeten the pill of having an upper middle class family who would otherwise be inclined to dislike. Probably.
So looking forward to Sophie Aldred's comments on the sofa when this is re-released.
That's it. They're not as posh as I was when I was on the show. You know?
Well, no one was.
And of course, she's sort of older. She's not being rescued from something so much.
Yes, that nice thing that we get now in the 21st century, or we were supposed to get it with Liz Sladen. It kind of is actually a bit like Sarah Jane's first story, where she's very much part of the narrative and pushing it along and solving problems along, get off, murder a cup of tea, that sort of upper middle class behavior. Yeah, very much so. In fact, there's quite a few little parallels to the Time Warrior.
So she kind of has to prove herself to the doctor in this.
Mm.
And, you know, the doctor starts to like her, I think, when they sort of first meet in the hospital. But he's sort of peripheral to the story for quite a long time, I think. It does spend a lot of time establishing her.
There are a number of moments where she actually drives the plot more than he does as well, where she basically starts trying to solve the problem even before he's said anything. When they're on the balcony, she starts working out the problem. She shows herself to be an intelligent and capable character quite quickly.
Yeah.
I like how, and you're quite right, James, I just like the way in which she's presented with different problems, and she takes a moment to process it and then work out what she's going to do and deal with whatever she's thrown up against, you know? And there's a strength in her. I think there's just this strength. The fact that she's slightly older than Rose, she's obviously the older sibling. The other two are younger. And in that opening scene, you know, it's obvious the parents' marriage has broken down. And there's a real strength in Freeman's performance that you can see the parallels with her mother. But she's also got aspects of her father who's quite comedy. She actually has some nice little asides and one-liners. It's actually a really beautiful, nuanced performance by Freeman. Now, I just want to say this to the listeners, and you might have gathered, that previously I dismissed Freeman's performance as Martha. It's been okay. I've talked about Martha's blank face, where I have spoken to Brendan about this, where I felt that she wasn't emoting. Well, I'm wrong. And she is just, my opinion has completely changed.
Isn't that interesting? So is mine, but back to where you were in the beginning. Because there's more than one slab on set.
Really?
Oh, wow. No, she's lovely and warm and charming, but as our friend Kevin Johnson, who taught at NIDA for, I think, a half a century almost, you know, they're C-class actors. And that's a bit harsh, isn't it? It's a term they use, which means that lots of warmth, lots of charm, but it's not getting over. I'm seeing a lovely person reading lines. I'm not getting involved in a character.
See, I mean, I think that, you know, the character as written is a little bit less, well, we've had more time with Rose, I guess. But, you know, that sort of slight, you know, we were constantly sort of cross at Rose for being sort of selfish and thoughtless and things. And that wasn't all she was. But in a way, Freema's character is kind of designed to be the perfect companion. And, you know, she's smart and resourceful and thoughtful and caring and selfless. And she's willing to put up with a whole heap of stuff, to go through a lot of stuff to help people. And so maybe that character isn't quite as complex.
But I've seen actors do a lot more with a lot less. No, I just think it's about performance and, you know, and just the way to get your character. It's almost alchemy, the way it works on camera. And it's different from theatre. She might actually be okay in theatre. And she's also an ingenue and all the rest of it. But the great warmth, great charm, and you can see just what magnetism she has in interviews and her enthusiasm.
Yeah.
And all of that is there, but there is the quintessential, there is that fifth element that an actor needs to get that across. And we still haven't actually been able to isolate what that is. And you don't always know it. In fact, the camera is a filter. Sometimes it allows and it magnifies, and sometimes it actually just shuts off. So the warmth of a person doesn't come through. But anyway, that's kind of what I'm getting from this episode. And it's a disappointment for me because it is a strong, light story. And Russell shows that you can have a Buckminster Fuller geodesic dome of great volume and surface area, but very lightness, very much lightness of structure.
I think that is something that I'm sort of keen to talk about because the actual plot itself. Fuller,
yes. I think we should be talking about moon architecture considering the time of year that this is.
The plot is very, very straightforward.
Yeah.
And I think it works incredibly well. We haven't yet really properly established a pattern where the first episode is kind of light and maybe a bit comedic. I guess with the third season, that's when the pattern is sort of finally established. But the fact that the initial problem is that rain is falling upwards is so easily comprehensible. It's not that the doctor's, you know, getting emissions well into the E band or something. Do you know what I mean? It's the rain's falling up. And I really think that that's, you know, something that Russell does really well, something that we haven't ever thought of before and that is super obvious. And, you know, the technobabble used to justify the H2O scoop is pretty rudimentary. But it makes for a great image, I think.
I like it as a condensatory heat runoff from all that energy thing. We're 7 days off the moon landing after the 50th anniversary. Yeah. As I mentioned, that's when we're recording. So there'll be lots of fascinating facts, Todd.
Yes, Richard. I think this is the most confident opener to date. And I love that brain falling up and actually having the whole hospital taken up to the moon. It's just something that I never would have thought of.
No.
And it just works so well. I just think this whole story is so confident. And I'm going to disagree with the man sitting next to me, Richard. I did not like Martha that much, but I just changed my mind completely. I just think she's fantastic in this entire story. I really think she's got the it factor. And I think it's really hard to follow up Rose. And I'm glad that we had a break last week. The doctor's managed to get to a point where he can accept Rose is gone, which is so vital. You could not have had this companion in the Christmas special. You needed that stopgap. And I just believe that throughout this entire episode, she just shines.
I have only watched this far. I haven't watched any further into Series 3 yet. I mean, I've watched it before. But I'm really looking forward to seeing how I respond to Freema's performance.
The hardest thing is that she's following up from Billy Piper in 2 years of what she's delivered and the fact that she's the not Rose, basically.
Yeah.
And I think that's a real noose around her neck. And during this episode, of course, the doctor kisses her for genetic transference and plot device. And then she, you know, this man's walked into her life. This, all this stuff's happening.
He spits. Thank you.
Do you know what I think the kiss is? It's a rehash of the conversation that we had in our episode at the end of Series 1 where Rose and the Doctor have a kiss, and some of us wanted to insist that it was a science fiction kiss and some of us wanted to say that it was a kiss. And here the Doctor is the person who says, no, this is just a science fiction kiss. And Martha, it is a kiss, you know, like she reacts to it. And perhaps for me that's the part of the episode that I don't like so much is that, you know, she's immediately kind of won over by the Doctor's invincible charms, one kiss, and, you know, she's sort of suddenly in love with him. And there's a scene she does a face in the final scene in the TARDIS where she says, no, look, I'm not interested in you at all, and then sort of turns slightly to camera and pulls a face to make it clear to us that, in fact, she is. And, you know, like, I think that's okay, but I do think that it all happens rather suddenly.
Oh, look, I would agree with you, and it's really hard thing to judge at this point. New Who fans only know of Rose being in love with the Doctor. And so does it make sense to go there again? As classic fans, we're used to not having people in love with the Doctor. Do we just ignore the fact that people could fall in love with him that quickly? It's a road that they're taking. Is it a noose around this character's neck? And we'll see that throughout the season. We'll explore that.
Because certainly the following year, we react against that immediately, don't we, with the, you know, the I don't want to mate conversation that Donna and the Doctor have. In Partners in Crime, Russell very definitely kind of takes on board the criticism or sees what the being in love plot does to Martha as a character. Mm. And I think it plays out well. We've talked about who gets the best ending of any companion in New Who, and I reckon Martha's very much up there. And it pays off the being in love with the Doctor all the way through.
I would agree with you, Nathan. I think it pays off at the end, but the path along the way is pretty treacherous and quite arduous at times, where you kind of think, just drop this, you know.
I guess we're not up to that yet. So from looking at the character of Martha in this one, I can see how the writing would you can kind of see where he's going with this, and it's a bit Bronte-esque, isn't it? There's definitely a setup for a fall already, because innocence and capability will never go unpunished.
Yeah,
in Russell's Doctor Who. But there's, and I wouldn't have cast, I think, any other type of actor. I think that the persona is there, and hopefully that will warm up and there'll be a bit more of the Tara King confidence building as the season goes on. I believe there was, but where we are with this one, there's a lot of flashes and distractions and a really able senior supporting cast.
Yeah,
I mean, you've got Anne and Richard, and who else do we have? And Francine. Yeah. I mean, really, and that's a cruel twist of lime, and that's all you get. Well, I mean, I wanted the full gin bottle, but I only got a little taste of Francine.
It's a senior cast, most of whom have been in Doctor Who before.
So Francine's been in Doctor Who before. Obviously, she was one of the cats.
She
hasn't changed much, has she?
I really like her, and the reason is that Jackie was such a superb, effortless comic character. We adored her at the end of those 2 years. Absolutely, you know, I've said before that I was much more upset about Camille's departure from the show than I was about Billy's. But so we get Francine, and Francine instantly repels any attempt on our part to like her. Yeah. She's brittle. She's super no-nonsense. You know, we immediately see her in conflict. Like, Martha has to kind of smooth things over so that Francine doesn't get angry at the party.
Have you never cohabited with a cat before? It's like Sutex back in the recording studio.
I think she's wonderful. I can't
it's
wait.
It's powerful, isn't it? Yeah, she's on the screen for nothing, and that's what I remember. And she's kind of outshining people. I think I said Richard before, but Roy Marsden and Anne Reid as Florence Finnegan and Mr. Stoke. I said that carefully. They really are propelling this thing along. Every time they're on screen, you think this is fantastic. I just wish the Pertwees or the older Doctor Whos had characters that were allowed to play up the comedy.
Yeah,
because I haven't really had a pair like this since Fury from the Tea.
He is really spectacular, I think, and he kind of underplays, like, the way he plays being stranded on the moon. You know, looking out and seeing Florida and saying, "I'm never going to see my daughter again."
Yeah.
And it's not like he doesn't overplay that. He's very restrained. It's
very believable.
Yeah. He's wonderful, like, taking the medical students through and making fun of all of their terrible answers to his questions. I can't believe that he hasn't been in Doctor Who before.
He has.
Has he?
He was in a Big Finish earlier that year.
Oh, okay.
Ooh.
He reminded me of who's the fellow with that incredibly fruity voice in The Space Pirates, the one that Brendan made terrible fun of. He's just got such a rich kind of BBC voice. He's wonderful. And then, of course, we have Anne Reid, who was
Nurse Crane
in Curse of Fenric with the accent, and who we've recently seen in Years and Years, and she's spectacular in that.
Yes.
Yeah, Russell's had her back, and I think, you know, he really wanted to get her for this role, and she's just so great.
She's so good. Like, she just manages the menace with the humor. It's just a lovely layered performance. Like, when she talks about what does she, who does she eat? Or kill?
She eats
the child princess of
Petrified Regency 9.
I just keep bursting out of my little straw and then burn in hell.
She's so funny. And that's such a Russell thing. You know, no, it's not, you know, the president of the planet Zog or anything like that. It's a little princess that she's killed in a little dress.
It felt very Magnus Gruber, didn't it?
Oh, dear. And the straw is a ludicrous bendy straw. It's not a science fiction straw. It doesn't have any lights or anything on it. It's ridiculous. It's just wonderful.
And she's got her slabs with her.
It's the line from Barbarella, isn't it? They are leather men. They have no actual substance.
So they're completely made of leather.
Yes.
Yeah.
No, it is from Barbarella. Yeah.
Oh, from the planet Zavirax.
That's brilliant.
Yeah,
he does great, terrific. If the dear listener doesn't remember, that they used those ads in the 90s had some bloke with a cycle helmet on because he didn't want to show off his massive herpes.
He's a naughty boy.
It's a very Russell joke.
Those ads? Yeah, we had them out in Australia as well.
Yeah. Back in the old days when the only pop culture references were, a flying saucer with Batman at the controls, which is just utterly baffling and incomprehensible. That's John Pertwee, I think, in his first season. Referencing a cold sore cream is really quite a new departure.
And they get destroyed by radiation.
Well,
yeah, they get destroyed by sort of whatever's like around.
Anti-science, right? Science. Yeah. 5,000 rads, please.
And the doctor gets to get it out of his foot or shoe or whatever it is. It's a terrible scene.
I hate that scene. Yeah. In fact, can we just
say he has horrid feet. Really unpleasant, hirsute, bony toes. It's really not what you want to see on.
Have we seen the Doctor barefoot
dinner
before?
Time TV? Oh, we've seen Pert's. I've seen Pert's back crack, just a little semblance. Speaking of intimate parts of the Doctor,
Richard, I'm going to have to go back and have a look at David.
Oh, that's really horrid. Oh. Brace yourself.
Okay,
I hate that scene. That's a moment where I find Tennant's performance just completely embarrassing.
Yeah.
And I have to say that there are.
He's not comfortable in it.
No. And I have to say there are a few other scenes like that. You know the scene where he is, for some reason, using his sonic screwdriver on the monitor of the screen in order to get something out of a database, yes, to get the patient records, which, why?
It's not a Mac.
No. And he has just the worst hair. Like, he's been running his hands through his hair and his hair's all over the place, and he just looks stupid, I think, in that scene. Now we get the introduction of an iconic monster. A monster.
Francine, yeah, we've covered
it. Can I just say before we go into that, and I've documented this in our podcast, that I have not liked her at all.
Yeah.
Like, I hate her.
Yeah.
Right?
Who do you want to? There's so many choices.
You're supposed to.
Oh, how can you not like Francine? You haven't had a cat.
Nathan and I had a big discussion about this. Uh-huh. And so at this point in time, watching just this episode,
yeah,
she's obviously a damaged woman. She's had to be strong for her family.
Yeah.
Right? And so it's a really good performance. And I want to say this. She's a tremendous actress.
Yeah, yeah. She's really something.
Even though I may not, I don't dislike the character at this point.
Yeah.
Okay.
But I think you're meant to dislike her.
Oh, no.
I think Russell wants that. Yeah, he's doing something different. We loved Jackie. She was immediately hilarious. She's the funniest thing in that first episode. And so now he's just getting us by bringing in some risk and unlikable.
The comedy elements are being transferred to her husband.
Yeah.
And Annalise. But of course they don't appear ever again except at the end.
I don't know. I would like to come in as a marginalia in praise of Saint Francine. Because I do think she is the woman who held the family together and has been tossed over for a younger one. I'm completely with her.
No, I agree with you. This is what I'm getting out of this. Oh, okay. She's had to be the rock of the family. And her husband has not been a great husband. He's a wonderful father, but he's a terrible husband.
He's a
husband.
Bit of a dope, too. It's pretty obvious that the intelligence comes from Francine. So it's true.
And, and Martha, as the older sibling, is the one that's had to support her mother and look after the younger
kids.
And
be the alpha in the family,
And that's where she's this linchpin of the family. It's absolutely a beautifully constructed scenario that we're going to explore. I'm totally on board, and at the time I wasn't, but I am now.
And I think that that's what the Doctor is rescuing her from at the end. You know, the Doctor was rescuing Rose from sort of life in a shop, whereas here I think she gets into the TARDIS because her family are having just this sort of massive public fight in the street, and he offers her a way of escaping it.
See, I think I prefer her father in leathers in Mind Warp.
His acting hasn't improved.
Mind Warp. Is it?
He's in Mind Warp. I rubbished him.
Which one is he? Is he one of the guards?
Yeah. He's the one who says the Rark was proud of his upgrading.
When I originally watched this, I really enjoyed Gugu's performance more than Freema's.
Isn't she shining in this? She really does, doesn't she?
Mm. But Freema's leapt ahead of her this time around. Her performance is much more, she's the younger sibling. It's much more a Rose type of character, and I see that now for what that is. I mean, I like her, but I don't know. I just went into this with different eyes. It's just, Nathan, you're smiling. It's big.
No.
And it's because I'm just finding so much more in this from Freema. I'm just blown away.
It's mostly because I can't think of an example where you've rewatched something and then reevaluated.
No, that's never happened.
Yes.
Listener.
Richard, Nathan, listeners, that that's never happens. Yes, James, you can smile as well. Let's go on to the big monsters for this episode.
Jenna Coleman's not in this one.
That's true, Richard. She's not, but she's coming soon.
Colin Neal will be able to comment on that.
I'm sure he will. Did you do? Yeah. On the moon.
A platoon, Jadoon platoon.
Yes, he's got his assonance generator out and running, hasn't he?
I actually like that line. It's so random. It doesn't mean anything.
You know why that line is in there?
No.
It's because the 00N... sound. It's really difficult for a Scottish person to say in an English accent.
No.
Russell.
He's been fronting bottom
around with David.
Is he really?
Trying to stop him saying platoon. Like, no, it was deliberately done I don't want to say that word.
That's hilarious.
No, you're right, because I've heard Tennant on his podcast talking about this exact thing with the 00 sound with other hackators.
It works for the Doctor because, you know, he's super verbal, you know, like that's, we'll see that in Midnight.
He doesn't gum up, does he?
Yeah. Ever. And so having him just play with words and the sounds of words, I think works really well. It's a fun line. What do we think of the monsters themselves?
Okay. Here I go.
That's Anne Reed, isn't it?
Richard, you're on fire. Absolute fire. I was really upset the first time I watched them.
Oh, wow.
Oh, because
you do.
I was really upset because I felt that they were ripping off the Centaurans from the classic Who.
They did feel like that, yeah.
Were sort of in leathers. And I thought, well, if the Centaurans ever come back, what are they going to do with them? There's nowhere to go.
Yeah.
Of course, now I'm over that. They're fantastic. The whole design, that whole rhino head, I think is brilliant.
So we only get to see one big rhino head, don't we? The rest of them keep their hats on. There's a lot of them and they look fantastic. They're all very sort of fetish wear, aren't they?
Yes, I really know where Russell spent his early 90s.
I think I prefer them with the mohawk.
Yeah, so they're coming
back.
Can't
wait.
They are coming back. Yeah, and they came back for Sarah Jane Adventures.
Oh, they did too, didn't they? Yes.
A good episode where he was a sort of cop, and they sort of played upon the sort of police thing of the Jadoon.
But I love the whole, I love their spaceships. They look fantastic. I love the fact that they scooped the hospital up onto the moon, which is just a wonderful concept. And then to assimilate the language, to go through that whole little process of actually getting somebody to talk Earth English and yeah. put it into their translator, it's like nothing. I just don't have an imagination. I just love the way Russell thinks about these things.
Yeah, it's all something that we haven't seen before.
It's an interdimensional magic marker.
Yes, I love that. And again, if you're going to do that, you know, like it's such a good... It's so good. It's so simple, you know, like it's not a space... Well, it is a space marker, isn't it? A space Sharpie. So you get a cross on your hand when you scan. That's true.
I think that's what's so wonderful about Russell's writing is he takes something so simple and just... goes with it and makes it a science fiction thing,
yeah,
without having to be some convoluted process. Yeah.
And it's the thing that solves the episode. Like we reveal Anne Reed for who she is by Freema grabbing the magic marker off one of the Jadoon and pointing it at Anne Reed. So it's definitely there and very well established. So the whole thing sort of fits together really well. I love their language.
Yes, it's almost as if it's post-Slavic, isn't it? Or it's very Eastern Bloc. Well, we really know where Russell's coming with this, don't we? Once again, he's mattering the entire discourse of our planet, at least as far as reportage goes. And this is just a comment. Around 2006, 2007, the cognitive dissonance of there was no moon landing.
Yeah, yeah.
And that we're now at the 50th moon landing. I had three people just the week of the moon landing last week say, oh, well, you know, it didn't happen. It was on TV. One was a chemical engineer whose father was a senior general in Afghanistan, but she's a chemical engineer. Another one is an architect I worked with. Another one was a bloke in the queue in Hi-Vis at the post office. But they all said to me, you know, there was no moon landing. I thought, you know, I ended up saying, I'm so sorry. And I got this kind of, you know, quizzical and confrontational, what do you mean? I said, well, I'm so sorry that that's how you have chosen to see 450,000 people's work,
yeah,
including folk I've actually shaken hands with in Australia who were at, you know, who were in Canberra, who recorded the first things. But Russell again talks about his horror of where we are with his lightness of touch and the cognitive dissonance that we are being told not to believe what's in front of our bloody eyes. So at the end of the hospital, oh no, there's that great line. And of course, it's Annalise who gets to spiel Facebook bullshit.
Yeah, but it didn't happen, you know, and Martha's being called a liar, of course. And he goes back to that well in Years and Years because, of course, one of the features of the current world is, you know, people just choosing not to believe that the world is round.
We've actually got that happening now. And I know it's my usual shtick of, Todd, I know it's my usual shtick of, you're mattering everything and you're going too far. But I'm not, because it's been proven. This is how Russell thinks, and Years is the evidence. Yeah, yeah. He was always thinking like this.
When are we doing the Years and Years podcast?
No, I think we're doing it now. I hadn't thought along those lines at all, but I think that's absolutely right. And the show, because during this era, the show rightly wants to make alien invasions into a big public spectacle, but it still wants to be set in our world.
Mm.
And they made fun of that, obviously, last episode with Donna, you know, scuba diving during various alien invasions and missing out on them. So she gets to be someone who's skeptical about aliens because she was hungover or underwater or something when they all happened, and somehow she's missed out anyone filling her in on what happened while she was down there. And the show has sort of played with that a little bit. I mean, even when the spaceship sort of crashes into Big Ben by the end of the episode, there are, you know, headlines in the Evening Standard saying that it was all a hoax. And so there is that kind of narrative level of it. But there is that thing that he wants to say is that we are really good at justifying choosing not to believe in things that kind of we don't want to believe in.
Martha is a bridge point for the viewer and for us sitting watching it, and that she is an ordinary person, a very capable and higher IQ ordinary person, sure, but really just an ordinary person who's worked jolly hard and with EQ and IQ, and he's able to see clearly and call out the nonsense.
Yeah.
And that's her ciphering role in this, is to say, you're all bloody misleading yourselves.
Yeah.
And that's the lovely thing. I think that's why she's fallen for the Doctor, because she's actually quite a Homeric character, isn't she? She's constantly in search of the truth. And if David's Doctor is her golden fleece, that's why she's fallen for him, because he is the final destination of truth.
Well, they're both doctors, so they're both, you know, they're both going to
that
be
should
doctors.
Be illegal, really, shouldn't it? Because it's not right.
And that's why she's so good.
Yeah.
And she's been touched by all of this because her cousin
well, he
was
kissed
at
her.
Stop it, Richard. Just stop it. He's nudging me.
That stays in.
Heaven help me. Please save me now. Like her cousin was at Canary Wharf and never returned, and so she's been touched by this. Just played by the same
identical
actress.
Cousin,
which is
totally a thing. Yeah,
totally a thing.
Well, that's all right. We're okay with, you know, Ian Marta turning up 2 years later, or let's face it, Colin Baker turning up a year later in the title role of the show.
Maybe her father wasn't just infidelity.
Had an affair with Francine's sister or something.
Why didn't they explore that more during this season? Back to the Jadoon. I like the fact that the Doctor describes them as like space cops or whatever, and then they go, that poor man that assaults them, he's just executed.
Yeah, yeah.
So that you get the sense that they are pretty harsh in their judgment, give them a bit more menace.
I thought it was for your benefit because you because you get rather sort of weary if there aren't enough deaths in Doctor Who. And so we have two here. We have Mr. Stoker and we have the person who hits the Jadoon with a vase. And it also gives us a chance to do another sort of another new effect for people being destroyed. Because one of the things that the design always does in this era is completely new spaceships like you talked about before, Todd.
Looks great.
Yeah, yeah. Each spaceship that we've seen has looked really different and isn't just the sort of standard detergent bottle with a few things stuck on that we got in the Hinchcliffe era for spaceships.
You know the most exciting thing for me, I really wish we had got a plastic washing up bottle. You know who the director is? Charles Palmer.
Oh, yes.
And he did a whole few this season. He did, you know, Shakespeare Code. And I'll go on to why I think this is all about cognitive dissonance, because the next story is about how Shakespeare wrote Shakespeare.
Yeah,
this whole season is about that. But jumping back, Charles Palmer's dad is Geoffrey Palmer.
Yes, yes.
Our very own
Geoffrey Palmer.
Our very own. We own him. He was married to Penelope Keith and everything.
But he, of course, appears in what, Colony in Space?
Silurians, isn't he?
Yes, he's in Silurians.
The Naughty Minister. Yes,
he's in Silurians.
Yeah, and later on he'll come back to be on the Titanic with Kylie.
He will.
He will. We won't get ahead of ourselves there.
No.
Back to the I can't say it. Back
to the Scottish accent. Don't do that.
No, I can't.
Don't do the accent.
Back to the space rhinos. I love their compensation thing with Martha as well, that bit of comedy. Like,
she
gets scanned. Like, it just tickles my fancy.
They are really good. And they're not villains. Like, we've got a proper villain who, again, is a comedy villain in Anne Reed. So these are just sort of aliens. And I think that they are sort of different enough from the Sontarans in the fact that, you know, their whole sort of concept is kind of different. And we bring the Sontarans back, perhaps not particularly successfully in the future.
Until you get Strax.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's when they kind of do it right. But they have to do it by kind of undoing the Sontarans a little bit. Yeah. I don't think we can ever use them again, for instance.
Got an appreciation audience figure of 88. I think it got 8.7 million in the UK and was ninth. I'm not really the expert on this. I'm just a fanboy, so it's in the back of my head somewhere.
8.71 million.
Oh, there you go. Thank you, James. See,
ninth most popular broadcast on television that week.
Oh, yeah, a top 10 episode.
Yeah.
It did better in terms of the chart than Runaway Bride.
Right.
Okay. Really?
Yeah.
Because Runaway Bride's at Christmas and has about 15 episodes of EastEnders to come in behind, probably.
Okay. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
I like the fact that the sonic screwdriver gets destroyed and then...
Nathan did too, because he was hoping for a pterileptal.
Well, then they should rephrase that. It does cheapen the fact that it gets destroyed back in the dark ages of the Davison era. Like, you can just replace it like that. But it's nice to have it not there, so they actually have to find a different way to stop things, i.e. pulling out the cord from the...
Yeah, unplugging it. And
which I just think is just so clever and obvious that it's never really been... Not much.
I actually really like how Martha's leafing through the instruction manual on the MRI thing to find out what button to press as well. Like, you know, it's sort of comedy and silly, but it also is character stuff about how incredibly competent she is.
Yes, she's presented with a problem and she's got to solve it and she just deals with it, right? This is the thing, I've got to get it done. I just think she's just so practical that way.
It's also the moment too, and I'm not quite sure that Freeman completely sells it or whether maybe the scene is a little bit overwritten, but when they're out kind of on the smoker's balcony, you know, of the hospital, sort of near the patient lounge, and the doctor and Freeman get their first sort of proper chance to talk, and the first thing that she says is, you know, I might die, but this is beautiful, I'm on the moon. You know, she's the one who realizes they're on the moon, and I think that is kind of the mission statement here. It's not just that she's super competent, it's not just that she kind of sort of sacrifices her life in a way, you know, to save the doctor, to make sure that the doctor's able to sort of solve the problem and save everyone. It is that she appreciates the beauty of the universe in a way that the doctor does as well. So she ticks all the boxes. She's kind of the perfect companion.
It's a doctor also working through his loss of Rose still from the previous episodes, and it's that journey that he's undertaking from Runaway Bride through these first few.
Is he horrible in this episode?
To her?
Well, kind of to everyone. There's another young woman who's presumably another medical student in the room with...
A jadoon.
No.
No, with Martha. He said, not you.
Yeah, not you. Leave her. She's crying.
Too slow. Leave her. She's too slow.
Yeah, which is really horrible. And she actually is...
It is horrible.
She's not incompetent. You know, Martha checks in with her later to get the stuff about the oxygen.
And she's actually... She's doctoring. She's helping people. She's
just in a moment of terror and not coping.
And the doctor just dismisses her immediately.
But that is this doctor.
Yeah.
And they've never all been entirely nice, have they? I think we all get it wrong when we turn into certain kinds of fangirls and go, oh, he's so romantic and lovely. No, he's not. He'll leave you in a crater with a horrible, horrible man irradiated with Daleks just behind your back door.
I think
sucker plungers poised and ready to remove the last of your hope.
But don't you think he's kind of horrible to her?
And he never comes back.
No. He is kind of horrible to her, though, in the TARDIS as well, where he says, you know, you're just going on a trip and that's all. And, you know, you're not replacing her and you're kind of... And I don't know whether that's the lines or whether those lines are kind of written to us as the audience or what.
Do you think he's being horribly, horribly meta Russell Clever and actually writing the Doctor with some of Rose's persona? Because you know that's where he got the accent from.
Oh, so maybe he's being sort of selfish and stuff. I don't know.
I like to think that Capaldi's Doctor is part of Amy, and that's why he's as... he's as Amy-like as he can be. Yeah.
I don't know. I think it's a bit of bravado, or he's just trying. He doesn't want. He obviously likes Martha.
Yeah,
and he's just gone through a loss, and he's seen that so many times, and it's him sort of dealing with that, saying, "Well, it's only one trip. You know, I'm just, I can't really cope with saying you're going to be here forever, like, yeah. because that would be I can't guarantee that. But he's not verbalizing that.
He does just come across as a bit obnoxious, though. And you can see him softening even over the course of the next two episodes. He's going to be horrible to her again next week.
He's oblivious to how horrible he is, and and her reactions actually sell that really well.
We all are, though, especially with those who are more in love with us than we are with them. I mean, this is actually Shakespeare. How funny we end up with him next week. It is.
Yeah, yeah.
Can't see Mary Tam putting up with it, can you?
No, no way. She'd be straight at him with a locator mutacore.
That's right. And burn a hole in his frontage. It's a big hole. K9 did it for me. I've got the all in on it.
I do like her reaction to the whole TARDIS. And
I love the mouthing, yes.
Oh, when he goes, it's bigger on the inside than the outside.
That was an ad-lib by Tennant.
No, really? Wow. It's brilliant.
And I'm so glad that she gets to say that.
Yeah.
It's just so perfect. And when he talks about being a Time Lord and she goes, oh, well, not pompous at all. Like, that's so Martha.
I love that Martha thing.
It's very Liz Sladen too, isn't it?
Yeah. I know you're a Time Lord.
This is why I'm falling in love with her. She might be my MVP for this season. Yes, James, you've got to be safe.
Martha's visible panty line.
Her tattoo's visible.
Yeah.
No, I think she got that with the spittle. It's the Pertwee tattoo. It just keeps jumping around. It's
a Pertwee tattoo.
It's a scented tattoo.
Well, you know the joke, though, that's the Corsair's tattoo. Pertwee's tattoo. Go back and watch Spearhead from Space. There's shenanigans there, James.
Say it three times and there'll be a Big Finish spin-off about this tattoo.
Written by boys.
I like, and it's a very Russell-y thing, that she observes that the spaceship's made of wood. Your spaceship's made of wood.
That's lovely,
and
isn't
that
it?
Is, you know, again, it's just that earthy, normal thing that Russell kind of brings to the table. It's very sweet. I think he's a bit proud of that line. I'm sure that it gets a mention in Confidential or something.
Except it's actually metal, isn't it? Because that's what Chesterfield says.
Oh, does he?
Yes. Oops. And, of course, police boxes are concrete. So, yes.
Look,
we know these things, don't we? So you don't have to.
Look, I just have to say that I thoroughly enjoyed this. I mean, I'm giving this a solid 8. I think Freema is an absolute revelation and delight. The family, I'm liking the performances, and it's a really confident start to the new series.
Looking forward to seeing how we go. Listener, that's all we have time for this week. We'll be back next week for our annual celebrity historical cage match between Gareth Roberts and William Shakespeare in the Shakespeare Code. In the meantime, you can find us wherever you get your podcasts, and you can keep up with us at flightthroughentirety.com, Flight Through Entirety on Facebook, and at FTE Podcast on Twitter. You can also find our Series 11 flashcast, Jodie into Terror, at jodieintoterror.com and at Jodie into Terror on Twitter, and our James Bond commentary podcast, Bondfinger, at bondfinger.com, at Bondfinger on Facebook, and at Bondfingercast on Twitter. Until next time, please remember to be kind to your new stepmother, Annalise. She's really very lovely when you get to know her. Thank you very much for listening, and good night.
Good night.
I was seduced.
Again.
Good night, everyone. See you soon.
That was Flight Through Entirety, starring Todd Bielby, Nathan Bottomley, James Selwood and Richard Stone. Theme arrangement by Cameron Lamb, strings performance by Jane Orberg. This episode, The Tara King Confidence, was recorded on the 28th of July 2019 and released on the 15th of September. Like many of you, we have a love of Doctor Who that owes an enormous amount to the work of Terence Dix, and so we would like to dedicate this silly episode to his memory. The blue suit?
love the blue suit.
Mm. I noted the blue suit. It's in my notes. I said the blue suit.
Yeah, I got sort of halfway through the episode before I realised that we'd never seen it before. And it is really good. And it's used as so often to kind of indicate the Doctor at two time periods. So when he stops Martha in the street.
He's wearing his brown suit.
Yeah, that he takes his tie off.
Oh, my goodness. That's the joke, the fact that he changed the colour of the suit.
Well, yeah. So he was in the blue suit and then – so I actually really like that you're only allowed to cross your own timeline for the sake of cheap tricks.
Yeah.
And
I never got the joke.
Yeah.
Like, okay, he's just gone into the TARDIS. He's taken off his tie. That's it.
The tie is a feint. Like, yeah, the tie is deliberately there to make you think, oh, well, he's just taking his tie off. But you realise he, in that split second, is –
yeah.
Changed his suit and gone back in time and taken his tie off in front of her and then come back.
Yeah.
I thank you, FTE, for explaining that to me because I've never got that before.
Yeah.
I don't think I consciously realized until I was watching it like last night in preparation.
I'm an idiot.
Yeah.
Just wait 1 second. I don't think that's true. I think he's wearing the brown suit in that final scene.
He is wearing the brown suit in the final scene.
So he doesn't change. He doesn't suit. Yeah. Yeah,
let's get it up on Plex.
Oh,
anyway, he does in the final scene, but he's wearing the blue all the way through. So we'll check that. It's different.
And if that's right,
I think that's fine because it is a different color from the same from the what he's wearing for the rest of the episode. So
yeah, that's right.
Hang on. If he's wearing the brown suit, goes into the TARDIS and just says the tie, right, and he's got a brown suit earlier, if it's all brown, just say we were wrong in our conversation we just had, then what's the joke?
Well, the joke is that he went back in time and took off his tie.
Yeah.
Which is pretty crap.
I can see 16 pages, threads of text on Gallifrey Base about this. I only need to say it three times. When is my Anne Reed and Roy Marsden spin-off series coming, Nicholas Briggs?
Are there dollies?
There ought to be. There ought to be.